I think prioritization, it's like the thing that has made me a much better CEO as well, because organizations need a very clear strategy. And a clear strategy is not when you have 30 priorities in that strategy. Mm-hmm. Organizations, people within also can't do it all. So you really need to pick, what is your strategy? What are the needle movers? What are you going after? And how are you going to execute on those few things really, really well?
Explore the minds and marketing strategies behind today's winning brands and businesses. Tap into the power of the creator economy with Earned by Creator IQ. Here's Connor Begley.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to Earned. Today, I've got Alicia Yoon, the founder and CEO of Peach and Lily. Welcome to the show, Alicia.
Hi, Connor. Thank you so much for having me.
It is so fun to have you on after all these years, and to watch you guys kill it has been fun, to say the least.
Oh, too kind. Thank you.
I think my favorite story from you guys is, I remember early on when I first met you, like, one of our customers described our product as a Rolex in a paper bag, and we need to fix that. And I have never forgotten that to this day.
Yeah, it's so funny because we focus relentlessly on product quality. Like, product quality, the formulas are king above all. And marketing, of course, is sort of how you amplify that message. And, you know, really early on when we first launched the brand, which is now, this year will be year 5, we were like, okay, we have these amazing products, but in terms of really getting the message out there, we were like, I just feel like our marketing strategy is not living up to the product quality. And a lot has changed, of course, over the last 5 years. But I always tell our team, I'd rather have that than have like a watch that's like this $2 watch that's going to break down tomorrow. But the packaging is so glitzy. But then when customers try it, they're disappointed, right?
I love to know that that wasn't just a one-off comment. Like, that has persisted as a concept internally.
It is. It's something that we actually talk about where, for us, product quality is something you can never compromise on. So the whole organization is fully aware of, we are delivering that Rolex every time.
So I actually have a more kind of timely question, which is, we're fitting this interview in right before your second baby. And I'm curious, you know, if we were to look over the last 3 years, the business has grown tremendously. You had one little one and another one soon to come. I'd be curious for both, one, what has that been like just for you personally? And then two, I just invested in a business with a woman who's also the CEO, and she is also pregnant right now. And my message to her was, I think you can be an inspiration to a lot of other women that are nervous about starting a business, but still want to have kids and how they balance that. So I'd love to know both what that journey has been like for you, and then also what your recommendations might be for other women that are considering the same path.
Yeah. So Peach and Lily as a company, we're 11 years old. We started off as a pioneer of Korean beauty. And then about 5 years ago is when we launched our two brands, Peach and Lily and Peach Slices. So having been an entrepreneur now for a long time, I have to say, honestly, having our first child was not as hard as we had anticipated. I think building a business and all the demands that come with it have been more challenging. But I would say that it's been a really exciting journey, especially over the last 5 years when we launched our two brands. You know, within the first 4 years, Peach and Lily, so we retail on our website and exclusively in a partnership with Ulta Beauty. And it's been amazing. In less than 4 years, Peach and Lily has become a top 10 skincare brand at Ulta Beauty. And Peach Slices, in less than 2 years, we launched at Ulta Beauty a little bit later with Peach Slices, has also become a top 10 skincare brand. And more recently, we launched at Walmart. And within the first 3 months, it became a top 10 brand in its category. And it actually remains the number one best-selling blemish solution at CVS. And so the last 5 years, needless to say, in growing these two brands have just been an incredible adventure. And throwing in the mix, yes, you know, having our first kid and now expecting our second, I would say the biggest thing has been prioritization. So ultimately, both as a mom and also as a CEO, I think it's so important to prioritize, because it's really unrealistic to say you're going to do it all and you're going to do it all really, really well. And I think prioritization, it's like the thing that has made me a much better CEO as well, because organizations need a very clear strategy. And a clear strategy is not when you have 30 priorities in that strategy. Mm-hmm. Organizations, people within also can't do it all. So you really need to pick, what is your strategy? What are the needle movers? What are you going after? And how are you going to execute on those few things really, really well? And I think like an analogy, like in my personal life is, for example, everything else, you have to have the discipline to let go. So for example, like, would I love if my son's room looks like straight out of a Martha Stewart catalog? Sure. Would I if he was always dressed in the cutest outfits? Sure. But you know what? Those things are just like not going to happen. His room is going to stay messy often. And at the end of the day, you know, I'm going to prioritize before bedtime. We're going to have our routine and have a no phone quality time. And, you know, that's just a small analogy. But I also think with the business, it's so important to pick your spots. Do that really, really well. You don't have to get distracted by all the other shiny things that other companies might even be doing. Stick with those priorities and you'll make some big movements that way.
I love that. I think that focus is one of the most underrated concepts when starting a business. And I think particularly because entrepreneurs in general, like, you know, you want to start something new, right? You're driven by new initiatives and excitement and these kinds of things, or pure ADD in my case. And so it's hard to remain focused when there's so many shiny objects. I love that conceptually. I think the other one, and I've told this story before on here, but I really liked it. It was a dean of this university. And it was a letter for women specifically, but I really found it valuable. And she was saying, there's a lot of pressure on women to be at all the PTA meetings and be a partner at the law firm and go to every soccer practice and these kinds of things. And she's like, that's just not feasible, right? You have to make a choice. And when you make those choices, you have to be comfortable with what you are not choosing to do. And she classified it as family, career, health, and then friends. Those were the big buckets that she used. And she's like, you can really only pick two of them if you want to be really good, maybe three. It was quite helpful for me because I actually spent a lot less time with my friends, right? And that was something that I chose in my mid to late 20s to not prioritize, right? I prioritized family and work, and then to a lesser degree, health. And so I love that message. I think it's important.
Yeah, it's true. You can't have all your buckets and everything in it.
No.
And, you know, and also it helps to know that there's different seasons in life. So you can kind of add certain things back in later. You know, it's just about going deep in those areas that you do focus on.
Yeah, 100%. So I'd love to take a step back and talk a little bit about kind of the founding of Peach and Lily. So just looking at your background from the outside, you know, it seemed like you were toying around with the idea of founding a company, kind of had a couple that you started, but then really took the dive all in after BCG, right? So you'd gone to Harvard Business School, then gone to BCG, and then really went all in on Peach and Lily. What was it that made you decide to make that leap initially? I'd have to imagine you're never going back at this point. So are you entrepreneur for life? Is that the plan?
I think for the foreseeable future, yes. You never know what's going to happen in life, but I love being an entrepreneur. And for me, you know, I am consumer number one of Peach and Lily, right? Like I grew up with very severe eczema. I still have it. You can't really cure yourself of that, but I've been able to really manage my skin and really transform how it looks and feels. And I grew up between New York and Seoul, Korea. So I'm bicultural, bilingual, and I went to skin school in Korea many, many years ago, like decades ago, to figure out how to manage my own skin. And I was tired of waking up with bleeding, visible rashes all the time. And it really did affect my life. And it took a few years after that, you know, back then there was no internet. So I was like in the library, in the stacks. I went to college here in New York. And so I was figuring out like all these different clinical studies and how these things piece together. And at a certain point, I managed to figure out, well, this is how I can actually transform my skin and started to see results. That just became such a passion. So I was doing facials for friends and family nights and weekends. My dorm room, then my apartment ended up looking like an apothecary all the time. I was going back home to Korea. Still were bringing Korean products back. And, you know, all along, I just thought with work, especially when I was in college at the time, like investment banking was a thing to do. And so I started my career off at Goldman Sachs thinking like, this is career stuff and skincare is passion, personal life stuff. And after business school, when I was at BCG, I just had this moment where in the back of my mind, I knew that I wanted to try something entrepreneurial. My grandfather is a serial entrepreneur, and growing up seeing him, I always thought that seems so exciting. But it always stayed abstract because I didn't find something I was passionate about. When I was in business school, I actually started a small Korean fashion startup, and the business model wasn't scalable for a variety of reasons. So I was like, okay, we're not going to do this after school. And I went back into consulting, which I really enjoyed. And when I was at BCG, I was meeting with a friend once a week, and we were just exploring different startup ideas. And it was very analytical and dry, like doing a lot of research, like mapping out business models. But at one point, I had this aha moment where I'm like, I love skincare. Like, it's been now more than a decade that I was like so knee deep in skincare. And it's 2012, it's a globalized world, and it's outrageous that these incredible skincare innovations from Korea, it's just not available in the US. And as soon as that vision and passion, you know, just I had that moment, it was so different than all those other startup bouncing ideas back and forth sessions where it was mostly my head. This was like, it was all consuming. And for about a few weeks, I couldn't stop thinking about this idea. And I finally went to HR and I was like, okay, once I finish this project, I really need to start this company. And they made it really easy. I mean, BCG, I can't say enough great things about the company. They were like, open door policy back, you know, definitely go try, good luck. And I was like, okay, that made me feel like I had, you know, I don't know, it just gave me the courage to take the leap. And it was funny because it was 100% driven by that passion, that vision of what can I do to help others transform their skin with these incredible innovations that are just not available here? Because I know how I felt when I had that transformation in my life. And yeah, ultimately just dove into it. I didn't have a business plan. I didn't have the savings I wanted. The first few years, it was rough, right? It was just all passion. And I just took that leap of faith. And yeah, the first few years, we made a very intentional decision at that time. So when I started Peach and Lily, at that time, a lot of my classmates from HBS, it was almost like a little bit of a playbook. You have your idea, right? Maybe yep. You didn't start it yet. And then you pitch various funds, VCs, et cetera, for growth capital. And there you go. And I realized that for us, it's a pretty meat and potatoes type business, right? In the sense that we're not building a tech platform. We're building a consumer goods type company. And I really believe that we should be sustaining ourselves, and that business model needs to work. And I felt that if you raise capital really early on, you kind of go down this path dependent journey where you're constantly having to raise money. And for me, you know, I thought it's really important in this type of business to make your business model work. Mm-hmm. And so I made the decision not to raise outside institutional funding, just did not go down that path. And so on the one hand, yes, it was really hard because you're seeing all this demand and the growth is there, but your cash flow takes a minute to catch up, especially in the early years. So yeah, going from a very comfortable job to having like $7 to my name at one point, not taking a salary and working out of my apartment, you know, like very common startup stories. But on the flip side, I think what was really important is that DNA of scrappiness, that DNA of getting smarter every month, of being data driven, of being really judicious about what things you really go after. Again, prioritization, that's really stayed with us. So yeah, that's kind of how I made the leap from corporate America at BCG to Peach and Lily.
Yeah, totally.
Here we are today.
In 2020, you did decide to partner with Sandbridge though, right? So Sandbridge Capital, yes. Which they've got quite the track record. I mean, they invested in Youth to the People, which sold for a ton of money to L'Oreal, Ilia Beauty, which sold for a ton of money to L'Occitane. What was it that made you decide, like, okay, we've gotten it off the ground. We've got this culture of scrappiness, right? We're very efficient. Let's bring in a partner. And I'd imagine some of it is, let's take a portion off the table so that we can go big. Talk me through that decision.
Yeah. So 2020, that was year 8 of the business. It wasn't a foregone conclusion. about year 6 and year 7 of the business, we started getting a lot of inbound inquiries from various VC funds as well as private equity funds. And at that time, we didn't need to raise funding. The business was quite profitable and doing well. You know, we thought about it, and my husband also along the way joined the business. So we really were talking about it together and thinking, should we raise funding at this point or not? And I think what was interesting is the brands Peach & Lily and Peach Slices launched in 2018. By 2019, there was just so much momentum, and we were like, okay, while we don't need to raise funding, we would know what and how we would deploy that capital to fuel that growth and momentum even more. And I think that gave us a lot of comfort in saying, okay, this is the right time to raise. And we ended up meeting various funds. And the funny thing is with Sandbridge, it was this instant connection, right? Because we had really aligned values. Sandbridge is huge on brand equity. And we always say we are building a brand to last. It's all about sustaining that growth, building a real brand that can be a legacy brand. And there are certain decisions that come with that. And Sandbridge is all about build it to last, brand equity. Like that is above all. And we just love that. Hmm. Plus, Ken, who runs Sandbridge, is just such a great guy. So we were actually going to do a process to figure out our partner, but we actually just told Sandbridge very forthcomingly, like it was just, we had gotten to know each other over like 18 months. And then we actually were like, this is a time that we actually can dedicate to raising funding because it was just super busy in the beginning years of launching the two brands. And so we just said, you know, we really want to do something with you guys specifically, and maybe just for a few months, let's just see if we can get this done. Otherwise, you know, we are going to do a process. And that was it. That conversation was early November. We started the due diligence of that whole process, like right after Thanksgiving. Ed, my husband and partner in the business, single-handedly ran that deal. You know, he had done finance before. By mid-January, we were done, sealed.
Wow.
And of course, you know, I was super, I continue to stay super heads down, focused on the business. And I was like, that was pretty straightforward. And Ed's like, that was a lot of work. Straight through the holidays.
Yeah. What's that like working with your spouse? And it's funny, your fundraising process was relatively easy. Baby number one was relatively easy. I'm very jealous of your general business has done very well. Tell me what it's like. Like one, I think it was 2016, right? When he decided to come on. What made you decide to, or him decide to want to come in? And what's it like to work with your spouse?
So in 2016, the business was 4 years old, right? Mm-hmm. And we were in the throes of behind the scenes getting ready to launch our brands. So it was just so much work. And Ed, his background is in the business side, but in biotech. So he actually also was a management consultant at one point. We met in business school, and we actually have very similar skill sets, if you will, with some different areas where we spike. And in 2016, when we got engaged, he had actually left his job in biotech to start his own biotech company, where he was going to launch some orphaned pharmaceutical assets with like really good profiles and bring it to market. But, you know, it's a little bit more of a B2B model. And so he had assembled this rockstar team of experts, et cetera, to take it through clinical trials, et cetera. But he was at the phase of the business where you're bidding for the asset, i.e. he had tons of bandwidth, right? Because you're like waiting for responses and like, you know, it was just, it's like, that's the name of the game and you can't like move forward until like certain things happen.
Yeah.
Meanwhile, like, you know, I'm just like working around the clock. So I was like, Ed, you know what? Maybe for a month, you can help me on this like one project at work. And he was like, okay, let's try. And I think that made it not so scary for us to decide to work together because it was just this finite 1 month thing. And I was like, maybe you can help me for a month. But then you know how it is, like with a startup, like it's so all immersive. And given also his personality where he loves to just dive into things, like suddenly it started to become this, like he was like this very integrated person in all these other things. And so he just kept going. And at a certain point, he was like, maybe you should actually pay me. It was like turning into a much bigger thing. Yeah. And we actually realized that the business was going through such a interesting time of growth. We worked really well together. So then we were like, okay, you know what? Maybe he was going to put his thing on pause and try just being Peach and Lily, like really focus on it for another 6 months or so. But we just never looked back. Like, it just turned into this great partnership. And now it's year 7 of us working together.
Yeah.
The first year, I would say that the challenges were, we were really trying to figure out each other's working styles and boundaries, right? Because both of us actually get really immersed in what we do, like really focused on it. And so it was just sort of like, how do we figure that out? It was interesting because a lot of people are like, that's a high risk move to like do this with your spouse. But I think, again, we took bite-sized pieces without like any long-term commitment. And then we realized it just really works for us. So in that sense, we continued because we realized like, wow, we make really good partners at work as well. I would say the challenge today is more so that because we're both so passionate and excited about the business, when things get busy, it's busy for both of us, right? And so that's like the only part where when you have kids and so forth, it's just really busy for both of us. So it takes a bit of a village, but we have like really supportive family around us. So when it does get really, really busy and both of us are really, really busy, my parents are in Korea. So it is a call to my very supportive in-laws. We're like, do you mind just coming for like a week or two?
We've got something similar. So we live in a place called Lafayette. And then my wife is part of a very closely knit family. She's one of four. And so her sister moved in 5 minutes away. And then her parents moved in 5 minutes away. And then her brother moved in 5 minutes away. So now we've got that base of people nearby. And it's really special. It's a pretty cool experience to have them be so close. And we can lean on them too when we're crazy, because we've got three little ones right now. So it's crazy.
Yeah. I feel very grateful and lucky to have that support when we need them. And, you know, even when we don't, our son adores them and they adore him. It's great.
100%. So if we were to look at the numbers, so let's go back to, you know, we were a paper bag and now I think we're getting a lot better than that. So in the numbers, 2019, you were the 96th ranked skincare brand, then number 69 in 2020, now number 41 in 2022. You've passed brands like The Ordinary, Skin by Kim, which is Kim Kardashian's brand, Dr. Dennis Gross, Dr. Jart. So you've passed some big names. I'd be curious, and this is all influencer data, right? So how you're performing with creators and influencers. What have you seen work for you guys as a brand during that time? And maybe what hasn't worked for you? And how would you describe your general philosophy on that side now that you have focused more on kind of the marketing of the products, not just the products themselves?
Yeah, I think one thing we always keep in mind is, what is your goal of influencer marketing, right? Because it's so easy to say, make earned media value or influencer marketing an end to itself, right?
Yep.
Because you're like, okay, let's just like grow EMV. But ultimately, that isn't the end goal, right? So when you take a step back, it's always about, what is the end goal? And for us, it's about growing, but having sustained growth, right? Mm-hmm. It's not about trend-driven, spiky, launch-driven growth. It's about real, sustained growth to really have a brand that lasts. And so when you take a step back, influencer marketing and the outcome of that, which, you know, you would measure through earned media value, has to be fitting into your larger marketing strategy of that end goal, which is sustained growth, sustained strong growth. And the way we define sustained growth is, there's high loyalty, there's high retention, and the growth is not spiky. I actually think it's really dangerous to grow in a way where you have like these huge revenue moments around launches and then it drops right after. Like, you can't sustain that. Or you have these big revenue moments because there was a partnership or a collaboration, and then you can't sustain that. For us, really strong growth, and it doesn't have to be mutually exclusive in the sense that we have grown really, really rapidly. But one thing I love about our growth is the quality of that growth. High retention, high loyalty, but also incredibly consistent versus like it looking like really, really wonky. And so that's something that we really focus on. So when we look at our overall marketing strategy and how influencer marketing fits into that, there's two things that we always think about. One is, when you have a 360 marketing moment, how is your influencer marketing complementing that entire strategy, right? And there are some moments where your influencer marketing might play a little bit more top of the funnel strategies. And there are some moments where it might be mid to bottom funnel strategies. And especially as you start scaling, I actually think that it is challenging to think of influencer marketing as very, very top of funnel strategies only. Like, mm-hmm. I think that still need some other awareness building things, and influencers are great at talking about the benefits of the product and things like that. Sure, you are raising awareness at the same time, but you really want to think about that mix and that overall strategy. So that's like one thing that we keep in mind. And then one concrete example to bring that to life is when we had this like out of home moment for Peach Slices. So right when we were launching at Walmart, and that's just such a fun and successful case study for us, because our goal was ultimately, as the largest retailer, you're now reaching like a much more ubiquitous demographic. And so how do you think about a marketing strategy, including influencer marketing, to ensure that your brand selling in is just the start?
Yeah.
You know, that sell through and how you grow and how you sustain with that retail partner and also on your D2C is everything. And so what we ended up doing was a really robust 360 marketing campaign. So we had billboards and we had transportation systems with our hero product. And what we ended up doing was not going so deep in that top of funnel marketing messaging where it's like so hard to process and you're putting like everything on a billboard. It's just like, no, like people need to recognize what it is mm-hmm. and the product they're looking for. So the campaign slogan was "Don't pop it, spot dot it," which is yeah. like a trademark term. And that correlates to our acne spot dot. So you have people like holding up the packaging. And we made it a bit disruptive, right? Where we had models, real people with real breakouts, actually like fishbowl lens, like popping pimples. You know, it's not supposed to be like flatter, you know, it's supposed to be real. And you're yeah. supposed to be relating to that as you walk by to be like, yes, that was me this morning in the mirror.
Yeah.
And then you just remember, like, don't pop it, spot dot it. So we had this top of funnel moment, and that was the right avenue for it. And then in terms of the influencer marketing, what we ended up doing was having a cohort of influencers across like various demographics to amplify that top of funnel messaging a bit. So we actually filmed them in front of billboards in their own flavor, kind of doing like a fun jig dance type of thing where they were showing the billboard, but also actually doing their own version of Don't Pop It, Spot Dot It. And then we had a lot of influencers in that mid-funnel category where they're actually showing the benefit of the product, right? So they're literally just like putting it on and showing like why this medical grade, incredible hydrocolloid product is working so well. And then we had a lot of micro and even nano influencers focusing on kind of the bottom of the funnel where they're really like, go shop here, et cetera. And it was really this mix. And that's just on the influencer marketing side, but that complemented our overall strategy, right? So there were the billboards, paid media, all of that. And then, of course, there's actual Walmart-specific marketing levers as well. So in your trade marketing, what are you doing, et cetera? How are you partnering with the retailer? So we always put that into context because I do think it can be very tempting when not everything is measurable. You've built this amazing platform where you have a specific way where you're measuring EMV. But like when it comes to billboards, it's like really hard to know what is the measurement there. And so it's easy for teams, I think, to kind of hold on to the things that are more like rankings and measurable to be like, it's successful because we grew this ranking. And it's like, no, take a step back. The goal is sustained growth and your overall marketing 360 program and how everything fits in together. I think that was a really great case study where we thought about influencer marketing as a powerful lever, but in the context of what are we trying to accomplish? And in this specific case, it was sustained growth, but also really making sure we give a kickstart to the Walmart partnership.
Yep.
But not at the expense of those first couple months at launch, it's off to the races and then it kind of just slows down, right?
Yep.
So we really built that out in a way where one thing that we're really proud of is we were incredibly successful launch there, but every week it just kept growing from there. And so, yeah, I think that's how we always think about it. And then specifically, I think the types of influencers you're working with, et cetera, of course, it's all about that long-term relationship, right? Mm-hmm, so it's really hard to kind of, when you get pretty tactical, you want those authentic brand fans and you want to just build those long-term relationships. But that's how we think about how influencer marketing fits into everything else.
100%. And I think that's very in line with what I see work based on both, you know, we're almost 100 interviews in and have been doing this for over a decade. And I think that's the approach that we see. I think our challenge as a company is like, how do we measure it in a way that encourages that kind of behavior? Because early on, when we just did like, here's your top line EMV, we saw all kinds of bad behavior, right? Like, oh, it threw a helicopter trip and it got me $2 million in EMV and I only spent $500,000. So that was a good investment. It's like, no, right? And to your point on this concept of retention, so if you were to look at, this is something we're just, I haven't even shown you this yet. I should show it to you. So you started finally looking at it. Like, what is the relationship here between the two? So the R squared, so if you look at the top 20, these are makeup brands. I don't have it for skincare, but it's going to be the same thing. So the R squared for the top 20 makeup brands on year-over-year growth and retention. So retention one axis, year-over-year growth the other, was 0.96. Right? So it's 96% of the problem. If you look at it for luxury, it's 0.78. If you look at it for entertainment, it's 0.8, right? Like it's 80 to 90% of the problem when you measure it over a longer enough time horizon. And I think that is most consistently the mistake that we see brands make is they get really focused on this month, this launch, this campaign, when the reality is this is a ground game, long-term, build relationships, sustain growth. And it's reflecting in your numbers. You guys are killing it. So congrats. Very impressive.
Thank you. Yeah. And I think when you also do like the contextual stories and show like case studies of how brands incorporate, I do think that you're really getting the message out there that, you know, it's about the overall strategy and it's not just about EMV in a vacuum or just like these spiky moments, but it's really about how influencer marketing could be a powerful lever and how you think about measuring that within a broader strategy that works for your brand.
100%. So I want to hit two more topics, then we'll do one kind of fun end of show question. So one topic I want to hit is I want to hit hero products. So I think they're a really big deal. People don't talk about them. But before I hit that, I've been talking all about Peach and Lily, but you've mentioned a few times Peach Slices as your second brand. One, what made you decide to do a second brand? One company's hard enough for me. I don't know how you do too. So like, what made you decide to do a second brand? And then two, just in terms of general size, I'd be curious, like, how is it doing, right? Like on a relative basis, is it like 50-50? Is it 70-30? Like what's the split? And then what are some of the challenges associated with that, right? Of running two brands at one time that are connected, Peaches in both names, but are clearly separate at the same time.
Yeah, so we decided to launch the two brands because we wanted to serve consumers where they're at, like meet them where they're at. So Peach and Lily is really about, so because I have very severe eczema, I have very, very sensitive skin. And I quickly realized that I'm not the only one, but essentially if you have sensitive skin or if you had a bad reaction to harsh actives or if you just don't want to be so potent with your skin as far as like the ingredients you're using, or, you know, you kind of overdid it with some actives and now your skin is in a reactive phase, whatever the reason is, there's a very large consumer base that essentially wants the best of both worlds, right? Because I was like, well, all the products that actually are gentle enough for my skin, I'm relegated to like very soothing and hydrating products only. At that time, I was in my late 30s and I was like, I need the retinol. I need, you know, and now that I am in my 40s, you know, these are things I'm leaning on. But all of the products with those super potent active ingredients for people with skin like myself or just preferences in terms of how gentle you want to be with your skin, it's just not a viable solution. And so for Peach and Lily, we're all about providing those clean, potent actives, but suitable for everybody. Mm-hmm. So that's a tall order. That takes a lot of innovation. So as an example, our most recent launch, the Retinol for All Renewing Serum, it's actually a patent pending formula and it relies on novel research. And we approach innovation in a very different way. So it's not like going to a lab and saying, here's a comp, like you have 18 months, let's go to market. We bring in cross-functional researchers, cell biologists, it's whatever it takes to figure this problem out. And there's this incredible novel research that came out. It's a pretty long-term study in vivo and in vitro that shows that with retinoids, the reason why it's irritating is biochemistry-wise, just whenever that goes into your skin cell receptors, immediately IL-4 receptors come out, and that essentially triggers inflammation. Some people may not see it as much because depending on your skin genetic profile, like if you don't have issues with atopic dermatitis, or you're just not sensitive in general, et cetera, you have less IL-4 receptors that come out. So your skin doesn't seem as irritated, but IL-4 receptors come out for everybody. What that means is retinoids for everybody will trigger some sort of irritating kind of response to the skin, whether you may see it visibly or not. Now, in this novel research, when you combine that with a certain percentage of ectoin, the IL-4 receptors are being kind of suppressed at almost 83% of them. So you're stopping irritation before it starts. So long story short, it's research like this and different kinds of things that are really breakthrough. It's patent pending, like nobody else has this kind of formula in this combination. These are the kind of things that we rely on in order to meet that promise, right? So now our Retinol for All Renewing Serum, and we didn't even, you know, we wanted the reviews to be like, we have such an avid community base that people leave reviews pretty quickly.
Yeah.
So we didn't do the whole like, let's seed this to all these people before, and when it's gifted, they'll leave reviews. That's helpful. But, you know, oftentimes our community has kind of said, I don't know, all those reviews that come from like, I received this as a gift, like it doesn't feel as authentic. So we were like, this one, let's just see what people say, customers who like purchase it. And it's been amazing because people are like, I was so scared to try it and I actually could use it and it doesn't irritate my skin. Like just the reviews have been phenomenal, but it's not just like, oh, it's not irritating. It's like people are leaving reviews like this actually works better than my prescription topical. And it's because we use a very potent form of retinoid that is the most powerful after prescription. But because you're not seeing that irritation, it's not two steps forward, one step back, right? Mm-hmm. And of course, like I am a big believer in like dermatologists and all the prescription topicals they prescribe. And there's a time and place for that. But it's just been exciting to see people see the results when they usually felt excluded from this category, which is a lot of people. And even avid retinol users being like, this is one of the most powerful that I've ever tried. And it won a lot of awards out the door. And for Peach and Lily, that's what it's all about, right? It's about reversing signs of damage, preventing signs of damage. It's about the glass skin, your healthiest skin yet. It's that movement. So that's Peach and Lily. However, for Peach Slices, acne is like one of the most searched Google terms for skincare. As an esthetician, like I know that when it comes to finicky, very tough skin problems like acne, rosacea, very, very oily skin, et cetera, those are very ubiquitous issues, right? So we were thinking for Peach Slices, let's address those ubiquitous issues, but let's meet customers where they're at. It needs to be in ubiquitous channels, right? So we're talking CVS, Walmart, the mass section, and Ulta Beauty. And let's ensure that the solutions are, it doesn't require a beauty advisor. Like you're just like, okay, that's for this capsule collection. That's another collection that, you know, we have one called Redness Relief. We have one that's acne OTC, but it's like very clean. We have our just best-selling like patches. And so you can mix and match really easily as well. And so it was really determined more by problem solution and where the solutions need to sit. And there was a place for sitting in prestige with beauty advisors with a different kind of shopping that occurs with certain problems. So it just ended up making sense to approach the brands. Now, yes, running two brands, there are challenges for sure. It's interesting because when the brands share similar values and the same ethos, even though they are very different solutions and they don't cannibalize each other because there aren't overlapping solutions within the two, there are incredible synergies too. There's a lot of cost synergies because you have certain shared efficiencies, both on the manufacturing side, as well as shared efficiencies on just like a team side. But you also have these interesting synergies in terms of how you're bringing people into your ecosystem and they end up shopping both brands. And I think we're the only brand in the history of Ulta Beauty where an indie brand that has two brands are in both the mass and prestige section. And, you know, like L'Oreal and Essie, you know, they have a portfolio of companies, but they're all like very distinct brands. And when we actually did our research, we knew that this would actually grow both brands independently in a much more rapid fashion than cannibalize. Because Peach Slices is not the lower cost version of Peach and Lily. Mm-hmm. So we were like, let's actually take action and put both brands in the same channel then. And, you know, some people can think, oh my goodness, that's very high risk. When Peach and Lily is doing so well, why would you put a lower cost? But because they're positioned so differently, and that thesis has played out, you know, and that was very data driven, like how we made that decision. And so both brands just started growing so much faster, but it's because of the way it's positioned and how we actually intentionally positioned and everything from product development to messaging to channel strategy, all of that. So I don't actually know of other beauty brands that actually have these two brands like this, and they're actually a very equal size.
Interesting. You don't see it often, right? Because we work with the vast majority of the industry. And that's why it's like very unique to me, especially same distribution channels and like connected, but not, right? Connected, but different. That's fascinating to hear them grow off of each other. This is not a good analogy, but I'm going to use it anyways. It's like they put a Starbucks across from another Starbucks and both Starbucks do better, right? Or put a Starbucks across from a Pete's and they both do better. Something there. Well, we've gone way over your time. So I want to be respectful of your time. But let's do one fun end of show question. So one of the things that I face often when I get done with work is decision fatigue, right? You come in, you're making decisions all day. And so when I get done, it's like, I don't want to think about what we're doing over the weekend. I don't want to think about what we're doing for dinner. So obviously you and your husband are both entrepreneurs today, right? I would imagine there's some pretty shared values there, although you are obviously CEO. So I'd be curious, who is the CEO when it comes to dinner and weekends? Like who is the one that has to make all those decisions? Is it still you or is it more of a shared responsibility?
No, it ends up being Ed a lot, only because he is like such a talented cook.
He's like
Iron Chef Ed. He's so good. Whereas I will try so hard and I burn water in the kitchen. Like I'm so bad at it. In the beginning of our marriage, I felt so bad because he was cooking all of our meals. And I was like, let me make breakfast today. And I did. And he was like, just don't do that again. Yeah, it's just, I don't know. I'm not very good at it at all, but I'm pretty good at cleaning. So, you know, just the core and cleaning, I'll make those decisions. But yeah, food, that's all.
Oh my God. So what's his like, he's got to have like two or three just like, you know, he just kills it. What's his two or three that he goes back to? The best of the best.
It's so good. Okay, so there's something, he makes his Eddie burger that it's like the best burger I've ever had. Any fish dish, oh my goodness, like any fish dish, I'm like, I'd rather just eat this at home than like a really nice restaurant. And the most memorable dish to me is postpartum in Korean culture, you're supposed to have seaweed soup.
Okay.
And he learned how to make seaweed soup, Korean seaweed soup, but added his twist to it with like pieces. And I don't know what he did to it, but I was like, this gourmet seaweed soup is so good.
Maybe that's the next business. You need to go to Korea and start the elevated seaweed soup. Well, I really appreciate you taking out the time. I had a great time. I'm so impressed. And it's fun to, like I said, you know, I think we met each other, what, 4 or 5 years ago to watch everything you've done since then. Congrats and good luck with baby number two. It's coming.
Thank you. Thank you so much. And thank you for having me. It's always, you know, I love listening to all the podcasts that you guys do. And Tribe Dynamics has just evolved into this like incredible platform. So yeah, thank you for having me.
We're trying. We're trying our best. All right. Bye, Alicia.
Bye.
Be a friend, tell a friend, and subscribe. Earned by Creator IQ. Creator IQ is your all-in-one solution to grow, manage, scale, and measure your influencer marketing program. Ready to unlock the power of the creator economy? Get started with a demo today at creatoriq.com.